This does not mean, of course, that change will be automatic. There's a long way to go before integrated schools become the rule rather than the exception. But without these individuals asking, "I wonder why," and "I wonder if," and refusing to accept the status quo as inevitable, it is unlikely that Secretary King would have made school integration a priority for the federal government. The lesson I draw from this example, as well as others, is that even the most stubborn facts of life surrounding you are worth questioning. Sometimes the most grave injustices and inequities seem so intractable that asking why they persist seems pointless. Some feel this way, for example, about school segregation. But most of what you see around you is not impervious to change or improvement. And the very first step toward altering what you see is to ask, "I wonder why," and then to follow that question with another, "I wonder if." These two related questions are just as useful to ask in your personal life as they are in your professional life. I know this from one experience in particular, which can serve both as a cautionary tale and as confirmation of the importance of asking, "I wonder." I first met my biological mother at a rest stop on the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey. I was 46 years old at the time. I always knew I was adopted. I can no more remember when I learned this fact than I can remember when I learned my name is Jim, or Jimbo, as I was called as a kid. I never recall feeling resentful toward my birth mother or abandoned, in part because my parents made it seem special that I was adopted. It also didn't hurt that I had a happy childhood. My parents weren't perfect, but they were pretty close, or at least seemed so to me. We didn't have much money, but I had all I thought necessary for a good childhood. A bicycle, baseball mitt, cleats, sneakers, friends in my neighborhood, 1 week a year at the Jersey Shore, two parents whose lives revolved around their family, and a sister who put up with me most of the time. Perhaps because of all of this, I was also never that curious about my biological parents. I was adopted through a Catholic adoption agency in a completely closed process. What little I knew was from a story my mother sometimes told about how she and my dad got a call one day that a baby was ready for them and that they should come to a hospital in Elizabeth, New Jersey in 2 days. When a nun brought me into the room where my parents were waiting, I was wearing a hand-knit sweater and a necklace with a medallion of St. Christopher, the patron saint of travelers. My mom asked the nun where the sweater and medallion had come from, and the nun teared up, as did my mother at this point in the story, and said, "I can't tell you. I can only say they come from someone who loves him very much." You might have thought that story would pique my curiosity, but it didn't. Mostly, it reinforced a vague feeling of gratitude. I figured that it had to have been hard to give up a baby for adoption, and I was grateful for the sacrifice. But I wasn't that interested in knowing more about my biological parents, because I already had what seemed to me a complete family. I also figured I knew the story. I imagined that my biological parents were teenagers, maybe high school sweethearts, who decided they were too young to raise a child. So I figured my biological mother carried me to term, put me up for adoption, and then went on with her life. That is a classic story behind adoption, and I just assumed I fit the mold. So I never really asked, "I wonder why I was adopted," nor did I ask, "I wonder if I could ever find my biological parents," even though my adoptive parents always said they would try to help me if I were ever interested in tracking down my birth family. Fast forward to 2012. By this point, both of my parents had passed away, each at far too young an age. Katie and I had a family of our own. With the birth of each of our four kids, I grew a little more curious about my biological parents, as none of our kids looked exactly like Katie or me. I wondered if maybe they were the spitting image of some unknown blood relative. But in the chaos of a full household, those thoughts were fleeting. Then one day, several years ago, I went on a run with a good friend, who was born in Korea but left with his mother and brother when he was 7. He was trying to track down his father and suggested I try to find my biological parents. I explained my lack of interest, but he persisted. To appease him, I agreed to take a look. When I returned home from the run, I went online And within an hour, discovered that adoption agencies in New Jersey will release non-identifying information about the adoption, which means they will share everything they know except last names. I tracked down the branch in New Jersey that handled my adoption, emailed them to confirm this was their policy, and that they still had my records. "Yep, right here in our files," came the reply. Who knew it was this easy, I thought, as I sent off a check to get my report. 2 months later, a 3-page letter arrived in the mail, detailing my family history and the circumstances of my adoption, which had been culled from reports in my file. The story was not at all what I expected. The letter gave the first names of my birth parents, a family history of their parents and siblings, and a detailed rendition of the circumstances surrounding my adoption. The letter read like the outline for a novel about Irish immigrants set in the late 19th century. My birth mother, whom I will call Geraldine, was born and raised in Ireland. When she was an adult, she followed her brother to the United States, where she found work with a wealthy family in New York City. She met and fell in love with an Irish bartender. "Explains a lot," Katie would say later. When Geraldine told my biological father she was pregnant, he confessed that he was married with 3 children. Because he was Catholic, he told her, he couldn't consider divorce. Apparently he could consider adultery. Just saying. Geraldine broke off all ties with him and traveled across the river to Elizabeth, New Jersey, to a home for unwed mothers-to-be. Geraldine spent her days knitting the sweater and talking with the nuns about how she might be able to keep me. She cried every time adoption was brought up, the letter reported. But Geraldine ultimately concluded that she couldn't afford to raise a baby on her own, and she also thought I needed a father. She stayed with me for 9 days in the hospital, right up to my adoption. The last line of the letter read, "She left the hospital broken-hearted." I was stunned. This letter answered questions I had never even thought to ask, like, did I have a name during the first 9 days of my life? It turns out I did. I was named Michael Joseph, after my maternal grandfather. I handed the letter to Katie, who started crying as she read it. She looked at me after she read the last lines and said, "You need to find Geraldine. You need to tell her everything turned out okay." 2 days later, I received a call from the woman at the adoption agency. I'll call her Barb. Barb had put together the letter based on the records in my file. "Jim," she said in a pitch-perfect New Jersey accent, "I've been doing this for 25 years. Jim, I gotta tell you, I've never come across a story like this. It touched my heart, Jim. You hear what I'm saying to you? It really touched my heart." She went on to say she couldn't tell me to try to find Geraldine because that would cost more money. "But Jim," she said, "I bet she's been wondering about you, right?" That was another thought, I'm embarrassed to say, that hadn't really occurred to me, that my birth mother might be wondering about me. I sent in another check and waited. Barb and I considered that my birth mother might have returned to Ireland. We also recognized that she might have passed away. Months went by and I heard nothing. In the meantime, I was contacted out of the blue about becoming the dean at the Harvard Education School. That process preoccupied me and culminated in a call at 5 o'clock on a Thursday evening in June 2013 from Drew Faust, the president of Harvard University. She was calling to offer me the job. My head was spinning as I contemplated uprooting my family from Virginia and moving to Massachusetts. It nearly exploded the next morning when the phone rang. It was Barb. "Jim," she said. "Jim, are you sitting down?" "No," I told her. "Sit down," she said. "We found her." Because I had been thinking about the call with President Faust the night before, for a split second I thought Barb was going to tell me, "Jim, your mother is Drew Faust." But that's not what she said. Instead, she described how they found Geraldine and how she reacted to the news. When contacted by Barb, who said a relative was trying to find her, Geraldine and her husband drove to the adoption agency's office in Elizabeth. Geraldine cried when told I had been found and explained to Barb that she had prayed for me every day of my life. "And do you know what her prayer was?" Barb asked me. "She prayed every day that the two of you would meet in heaven." Turns out Geraldine hadn't returned to Ireland after all. She had met and married a wonderful man I will call Joe, had 4 more kids, and moved to New Jersey. She and her family lived 15 minutes away from where I grew up. Her kids went to Catholic schools that friends of mine attended. Our paths probably crossed at some point during my childhood. A few days later, Geraldine and I talked by phone. I first talked to her husband, and before he could say a word, I blurted out something like, "I'm not crazy, I'm not looking for money, I'm not emotionally needy, at least not usually. I just wanted to say thanks and to let Geraldine know that everything turned out okay and that I'm happy." I could hear him smiling on the other end of the phone, and all he said was that, "She's been waiting a long time for this, Jim, and she is the most amazing woman I've ever known." When Geraldine and I finally spoke, the conversation was both surreal and completely natural. She still has an Irish brogue. She asked about Katie and our kids. Then she asked about me, tentatively. We agreed to talk more and, eventually, to meet. For convenience, we picked a rest stop on the Garden State Parkway because, well, that's where people from New Jersey would think to meet. That morning, my family and I left our home in Virginia for the last time, the only home our kids had known, on our way to a new home in Massachusetts. Our kids were distraught about the move. They hadn't really paid much attention to the Geraldine affair, in part because they were preoccupied with moving, and in part because they adored my mother, their grandmother, who had passed away a few years earlier. But when they saw Geraldine, they stopped on a dime and looked back and forth between her and me. Geraldine is barely 5 feet tall, spry, and looks like me in a wig. Our likeness is unmistakable and uncanny. In an instant, my kids knew that they were implicated in this whole experience, because they could see a part of themselves in this otherwise total stranger sitting in the rest stop food court just outside of the Dunkin' Donuts. We sat for 2 hours talking, looking at pictures, and holding hands. As we left, Geraldine handed my kids envelopes with their names on them. Each card in the envelope contained a $20 bill, which Geraldine suggested they use as ice cream money for the summer. I eventually met my 4 half-brothers and sisters, one of whom could be my twin, and I talk with Geraldine every couple of weeks. It's a completely and surprisingly uncomplicated relationship, and Geraldine is not shy about suggesting I might call more often. She is impossible not to like. She is quick to smile and laugh, and she is gentle and unfailingly caring. She is familiar and close without being possessive. If I had never bothered to ask, "I wonder why I was adopted," and then ask, "I wonder if I could find my biological mother," I would never have met Geraldine and her family. To say that my life is richer because I did ask those questions is an understatement. To think that I believed I already knew Geraldine's story was, in retrospect, ridiculous. Just how wrong I was came home to me the day Geraldine introduced me to her other children, all of whom are about my age. We walked into her daughter's house, and Geraldine reached for my hand and didn't let go until I had met all of her other children. Then she turned and gently, without asking or hesitating, fixed my collar. And I realized, even though she would never be my mother, in the sense that no one could ever displace my adoptive mom, to Geraldine I have always been and always would be her son. This is not a story about changing the world, of course, but it did change my world in a remarkable and meaningful way. And this leads to the final point about asking, "I wonder why," and "I wonder if." These are questions that are useful to ask not simply about the world around you, but to ask yourself. I'm not trying to peddle a self-help program here, or to endorse navel-gazing, but I believe it's healthy and productive to remain curious about yourself. Why do you have certain habits? Why do you like certain places, foods, events, and people? And what if there are others you would like just as much if you gave them a chance? Why do new experiences make you nervous? Why are you quiet in meetings or shy at parties? Why are you easily distracted? Why do you sometimes lose your patience with certain members of your family? And what if you tried to change those things about yourself that you would really like to change? Or, just as importantly, what if you just accepted some of those things as part of who you are? In sum, the question, "I wonder why," is essential because it is at the heart of curiosity and the way to remain interested in the world around you, including your place in it. "I wonder if" is essential because it is the way to remain engaged in the world and to begin thinking about ways to improve your corner of it. If you fail to ask these questions, you risk missing out on joys and possibilities that you don't even realize exist, and, as with Geraldine, are sometimes closer than you could ever imagine. Chapter 3. Couldn't we at least? The third essential question led to my fourth, equally essential child, Phoebe. I realize that might seem hard to believe, but it's true. Katie and I planned to have three kids, but then Katie changed her mind. After our third son, Ben, was born, Katie began saying that our family didn't seem complete. Each time she said this, over the course of an entire year, I honestly thought she was joking. To a neutral observer who witnessed our three boys, the notion that our family was incomplete would not have immediately sprung to mind. Besides, Katie isn't especially new agey, so when she said our family didn't seem complete, which sounded a little mystical for her tastes, it really did seem like a joke. A year later, as she continued making this observation, I finally realized she wasn't joking. I asked if it was because we only had boys and she wanted a girl. I knew she was hoping to use the name Phoebe, spelled P-H-E-B-E, an unusual spelling of Phoebe that extends back in Katie's family, to a relative who was accused and then exonerated during the Salem witch trials. That wasn't it, Katie said. She was indifferent to gender, and in some ways she thought a boy would be preferable given that we already had all the clothes and gear. She just felt like our family could use one more child. I still thought she was crazy, in part because Ben was our easiest child, and it seemed to me we should quit while we were ahead. To put off a real conversation about the topic, I made a point of waiting until the absolute height of chaos in our house, say, for example, a Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, when all three boys were up, two were melting down, and the third was nowhere to be found. And then I would say, "You know what would really round out this picture? A newborn." That bought me another year. Katie, however, remained undeterred. But we were clearly stuck, as Katie had made up her mind, and so had I. And then she pulled out the perfect question. Couldn't we at least talk it through and talk about what it would mean for our family? So we talked it through and then talked some more. And just 2 short years later, I finally came around. A bit more than 9 months after that, Phoebe came around as well. Katie was right. I couldn't imagine our family without Phoebe. It was indeed incomplete without her. Like the second essential question, couldn't we at least, forms the core of a series of questions rather than one specific and complete question. Regardless of the variety of ways this question can be posed, at its core, asking, "Couldn't we at least?" is a good way to get unstuck. It is a way to get past disagreement, to form some consensus, as in, "Couldn't we at least agree?" It's also a way to get started, even when you're not entirely sure where you'll finish, as in, "Couldn't we at least begin?" No matter its specific form, asking questions that begin with, "Couldn't we at least?" is the way to make progress. To begin, asking, "Couldn't we at least agree?" is a way to find common ground. The key to maintaining healthy and productive relationships is consensus, whether in politics, business, marriage, or friendship. Asking, couldn't we at least agree, especially in the midst of an argument, is a good way to pause, step back, and look for some areas of agreement. After taking a step back and finding some consensus, you might have just what you need to take two steps forward, which is just how progress often works, one step back, two steps forward. Seeking common ground is especially important today. The explosion of information fueled by the internet and social media should in theory help bring us into contact and engagement with ideas, facts, and beliefs that challenge our own, which in turn should help us moderate our views and keep an open mind. In reality, the opposite is happening. Studies of social media, Facebook in particular, show that we are creating virtual gated communities where those with like-minded views only share information that confirm their beliefs. Traditional media, meanwhile, increasingly cater to segments of the population. Conservatives watch Fox News. Liberals watch MSNBC. Both groups find confirmation for their existing opinions. Our virtual worlds are becoming so segmented that we can even choose from different broadcasts of the same sporting event, one that favors the home team or one that favors the visiting team. More and more, we can choose to see only what we want to see. This is unfortunate and dangerous because of a phenomenon social scientists call group polarization. When like-minded individuals get together, online or in real life, they tend to reinforce each other's views. They not only increase the strength of each other's convictions, but they often lead each other, intentionally or not, to take even more extreme positions. If you dislike the New York Yankees, for example, and you only hang around with others who are equally misguided, you are likely to become even more convinced that the Yankees are a bad and morally corrupt team. In fact, you are likely to take it a step further and begin to believe that the Yankees are an evil blight on the national pastime. I have seen this happen at Fenway Park in Boston, and as a Yankees fan, I can tell you, it's not pretty. Asking, couldn't we at least agree, is a way to push back against polarization and extremism, because it is an invitation to find some areas of consensus. If you can find some common ground with others, especially those with different views, you are likely to see the world as a more nuanced place. At the very least, you are less likely to demonize those with whom you disagree. Take the Red Sox and Yankees again. Derek Jeter recently retired from the Yankees. He was an outstanding player and an admirable person on and off the field. David Ortiz retired from the Red Sox at the end of the 2016 season. Big Poppy, as he is called, was also a great player and rightly beloved. To find common ground among Yankees and Red Sox fans, bringing up Jeter and Big Poppy is usually all you need, as fans on both sides of the divide usually admire Jeter and Big Poppy. Once these two are part of the conversation, it lowers the temperature of any disagreement. The question, couldn't we at least agree, works just as well with disputes about the Constitution as it does with baseball, as my friend and law school roommate Doug Kendall showed. For decades, liberals and conservatives disagreed about how to interpret the Constitution. Conservatives argued that judges should follow the original intent of the Constitution. Whatever the framers thought the Constitution meant centuries ago is what it should mean today. Because this approach seemed to preclude the possibility that the Constitution could adapt over time, liberals rejected it, arguing for a living Constitution that could be updated by judges to fit modern times. Conservatives attacked the living Constitution approach as giving judges too much discretion, while liberals attacked the original intent approach as putting judges in a straitjacket sewn centuries ago. Doug saw the obvious weaknesses in both approaches. He also saw an opening to advance his own view. He challenged the liberal view by asking, couldn't we at least agree that everyone should care about the actual meaning of the words in the Constitution? And he challenged the conservative view by asking, couldn't we at least agree that a lot of important provisions in the Constitution are open-ended and establish general principles rather than concrete and specific rules? And couldn't we at least agree that the application of those general principles might change over time as circumstances, facts, and values change? If you adopted a general principle that you will only eat healthy food, for example, you would be acting consistently with that principle if you changed what you ate over time, as the science of nutrition revealed that some foods you thought were healthy were not, and vice versa. Doug argued that the Constitution worked the same way, and that you could indeed be faithful to its principles, even if the application of those principles changed over time in light of new facts. To advance his view of the Constitution, Doug created the Constitutional Accountability Center, or the CAC, a public interest group based in Washington, D.C. CAC participated in cases, produced reports about the original meaning of key provisions in the Constitution, and became involved in judicial appointments. In a relatively short period of time, Doug and his colleagues established CAC as one of the leading voices in debates about the Constitution, and in the process helped change the conversation about the Constitution. Liberal lawyers and judges are showing much more interest in the original meaning of the Constitution, and they are now joined in healthy debates with their conservative colleagues about that meaning. More generally, there is a deeper appreciation that the Constitution, as amended over two centuries, is itself a document that has evolved to establish and enshrine principles of equality alongside principles of liberty. And along the way, Doug earned the respect and admiration of liberal and conservative lawyers alike. To be sure, Doug's move was in part strategic. He believed that if liberals would actually take on conservatives over the true meaning of the language in the Constitution, they would often prevail. In this sense, asking, "Couldn't we at least agree?" was both a call to find some common ground and the first step in an effort to win a larger battle over the meaning of the Constitution. In a way, Doug's approach was similar to Katie's approach when she asked me if we could at least talk about what it would mean to have a fourth child. Both Doug and Katie believed that finding some common ground was a first step toward persuading others to their views, and both were remarkably effective in doing just that. Asking, "Couldn't we at least agree?" will not resolve all disagreements, of course, but it can at least reduce their scope. Finding some common ground, in other words, can help isolate true areas of disagreement. This is especially helpful in preventing opposing sides on a particular issue from wasting time questioning the motives of their opponents, which happens far too frequently in public debates. Education debates, sadly, are a prime example. You might think that those working in education would start from the premise that everyone in the field cares about the welfare of kids. Instead, warring sides in education debates are constantly questioning each other's motives. Those who favor charter schools, for example, are routinely accused of wanting to privatize public education and turn it over to hedge fund billionaires. Those who support teachers' unions are similarly maligned as supposedly caring more about the welfare of teachers than the children they teach. This all-too-common approach to education debates is both poisonous and unproductive. To assert that those who disagree with you must have dubious or immoral goals is basically to announce that there's nothing left to discuss. If it were instead possible to begin with an honest conversation about values and goals, and to discover some agreement about those values and goals, education debates might actually be edifying. Again, I am not at all suggesting that simply asking, "Couldn't we at least agree that we all care about the welfare of kids?" will resolve every difference among education warriors. But it might remove some acrimony and lead to constructive rather than destructive disagreements and debates. In addition to inviting some agreement, asking, "Couldn't we at least," is also a great way to get moving, even when you don't have a fully formed plan. As the astute philosopher Mary Poppins recognized, a job begun is a job half done. Easy for her to say, given that she could magically move objects without touching them, but still, it's good advice. Too often, whether because of procrastination, fear, or a desire for perfection, we hesitate to begin a project at home or at work if we cannot see precisely how or when it will end. Yet sometimes the most important decision you can make is the decision to get started. One of my favorite quotes, sometimes attributed to the German writer Goethe, is this: "Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it." I have seen the wisdom of this observation in both my personal and professional life. Katie and I had always wanted to live abroad for a year with our kids. We thought it would be a great experience for them, and we believed it would bring us closer as a family. Life crept up on us, however, and several years ago, we realized we needed to do it soon or not do it at all. When Katie and I also realized that we couldn't go away for an entire year, we considered giving up on the idea altogether. But eventually we decided that we could go away for at least a semester during my sabbatical, and we ultimately picked New Zealand. As soon as we fully committed to going, all sorts of things fell into place. I got an appointment as a visiting professor at the University of Auckland. We found a great public school for our kids, a place to live, and a car to drive. Though shorter than we had originally planned, our stay in New Zealand was one of the most enriching and rewarding 5 months in our life as a family. All because we asked, couldn't we at least, instead of giving up on the idea altogether? Asking this question has also been a useful way to help my kids overcome fear when trying new things. Skiing is one example. I love to ski, and I selflessly decided to teach my kids to ski in the hope that they would get hooked and then I would have the perfect excuse to go on ski trips. But skiing is a little overwhelming at first. The combination of strange gear, the size of the mountains, and the cold weather can cause new skiers, of any age really, to be less than enthusiastic or adventurous. I discovered if I asked, couldn't we at least, when trying to nudge them to try something new, it often worked. So when they were afraid of the chairlift, I would say, couldn't we at least go over to see what it looks like? Or when they were afraid of going down certain trails, I would say, couldn't we at least ski to the top of the trail and take a look down? I wasn't insisting that we get on the lift or go down the trail, just that we take a look. This didn't always work, to be sure. Couldn't we at least is an essential question, not a miracle question. But it was often just a question my kids needed to hear in order to help them take the next step. Sometimes, just seeing the object of your fear up close, rather than simply in your imagination, can help you overcome it. Asking, couldn't we at least take a look, can nudge you and others to do just that. On the professional front, as dean, I have never once regretted asking, couldn't we at least get started on something, whether it was a new project or new initiative? I have discovered, consistent with Goethe's observation, that once you commit to something, you often end up mobilizing a stream of resources, ideas, and assistance that you never imagined would come your way. Perhaps the best example of this came 2 years ago when my colleagues and I at the education school decided to start a campus-wide conversation on the theme of fulfilling the promise of diversity. We started this conversation for two primary reasons. First, we did not have any common courses among our 13 master's programs, which I thought was unfortunate for a professional school. Students in separate programs would never be brought together to focus on a particular body of knowledge, a common set of questions, or a cluster of specific skills. But as a new dean, this was not something that I could change right away. It did seem, though, that we could at least have a campus-wide conversation about a common topic, featuring lectures, panels, student-led projects, and faculty workshops, all focused on the topic of diversity. Second, we chose diversity as a topic because the world of education, like the world in general, is becoming more diverse. And we thought it was important to prepare all of our students to work productively and to be successful leaders in the field. Diversity has the potential to make institutions and organizations stronger, but it also has the potential to create divisions. This conversation was aimed at understanding how to ensure that diversity is a source of strength rather than a source of division. It would also help all of us become more comfortable having hard conversations about race, identity, and equity, conversations that we insist are necessary but too often put off to the future. I was also motivated to have a conversation on this particular topic because of an experience I had as a law student at the University of Virginia. A good friend, Ted Small, who is also a hero of mine, noticed that black and white law students at UVA self-segregated and largely kept to themselves. As a black student at Harvard, he had dealt with similar issues as an undergraduate, but the situation at UVA seemed even more severe. He suggested that we create a biracial group of 10 law students who would meet monthly over dinner to discuss topics related to race. We called the group Students United to Promote Racial Awareness, or SUPRA for short. SUPRA is a Latin legal term, so the acronym doubled as a law nerd joke. When Ted started the group, he had no real idea where the conversation would lead, but he thought, and I agreed, that it was important to do something. In a very real sense, he was asking, couldn't we at least get 10 students together to talk about these issues and maybe show that black and white law students can discuss hard issues together and perhaps become real friends in the process? By the time we graduated, our group had shared a lot of meals and a lot of conversations, some difficult, some challenging, others humorous and lighthearted. We emerged as friends, and our example helped spur a dozen additional supergroups to form among our fellow law students. Although I did not fully appreciate it at the time, participating in SUPRA was one of the most formative and significant experiences I've ever had. To this day, I continue to rely on it as a guide, including in our community conversation at the Harvard Education School. Our conversation at the education school produced mixed results. On the plus side, it quickly became clear that there was a great deal of interest in this topic among students, faculty, and staff. On the other hand, it also became clear over the course of the year that we were not sufficiently organized to meet the demands of this topic. Some students rightly complained that they weren't sure where the conversation was headed and that there was not enough structure to it. They also believed, again rightly so, that we were not doing enough. So we continued the conversation the next year. We provided more structure to the conversation, brought in more speakers, assigned a common reading, and added more than a dozen courses on race, diversity, and equity to our curriculum. This conversation also carried over into a redoubled effort to diversify our faculty and staff. It led to renewed attention and effort on the part of faculty to create inclusive and rigorous classroom experiences. And it enabled us to tap into the talent and expertise among our doctoral students who led seminars and discussion groups, as well as workshops for faculty. At the end of 2 years, what started as a loosely organized conversation had become an important part of the school's identity across a range of contexts, from the classrooms to faculty hiring to the work environment for staff. The conversation is not over, and there is still plenty of work to do. But by committing to starting this conversation, we set in motion forces that have, I believe, made our school stronger and helped us better prepare our students to be leaders of diverse and equitable schools and organizations. By highlighting this example, I do not mean to suggest that everything we have pursued at the education school has been successful. Hardly. But even efforts that failed or were disappointing had something to teach us. Getting started does not guarantee success, but it does guarantee that you will not live with regret about failing to try, which is the last point of this chapter. When you ask, couldn't we at least? You are essentially suggesting that you and others try to do something, whether it is to come to some agreement or to get started on something. If you don't ask this question, you are less likely to try. And failing to try, I believe, is a source of some of our deepest regrets. Indeed, this is why I talked about the sin of omission in my second graduation speech at Harvard. I believe that what we don't do often haunts us more than what we actually do. I am certainly not the first or only one to recognize this. Bonnie Ware, a nurse who cared for dying patients, published a book about the most common regrets her patients expressed. The number one regret was failing to pursue their dreams, failing, essentially, to try or to get started. My own experience with this particular source of regret is not linked to pursuing a dream, but instead connected to my mother's death. My mother fell and broke her hip in August of 2009. At 71, she was relatively young but had already endured a number of maladies that made her somewhat frail and vulnerable. Over a torturous 5-week period after her fall, she suffered from one complication after another. There were a few times when I thought she was not receiving the care she needed. But for a number of reasons, I didn't push the doctors to do more, and I didn't look for ways to get her to a different hospital or a different team of doctors. 5 weeks after she fell, she suffered a series of strokes and died in the hospital while my sister and I held her hand. Everyone around me assured me that the doctors had done all they could, and that I had as well. But I didn't feel that way. I didn't blame the doctors, but I blamed myself for not pushing harder or doing more. Essentially, I blamed myself for never asking, couldn't we at least get a second opinion? Maybe the result would have been the same, but it's impossible to know, which is a heavy weight to bear. That's the problem with not trying. You will never know what the outcome might have been. Even if you think the result would have been the same, that's only a small comfort. When it comes to helping your friends and family, what you want most is to believe that you tried everything you could to help. That is a sad story, I realize, but it has made me even more certain that the attempt is often more important than the result. I am confident from my own experience that every time you attempt to lend a hand, or to right a wrong, or to speak up, you will feel better about the world and about yourself. When you act, you may make a mistake. When you speak, you may say the wrong thing. But it is much better to fail while daring greatly than to be a bystander, to borrow a line from Teddy Roosevelt. If you fail while trying, often the worst thing that can happen is that you will have a funny story to tell. I have never heard a single funny story about failing to try. Because it helps break log jams, whether created by disagreement, fear, procrastination, or lethargy, and whether created by external obstacles or internal ones, the question, couldn't we at least, sparks movement. It is a question that also recognizes that journeys are often long and uncertain, that problems will not be solved with one conversation, and that even the best efforts will not always work. At the same time, however, it is the question that recognizes you have to begin somewhere. It is the question that nudges you and others to the starting line. It is the question, as I said at the opening, at the heart of all progress. And for that reason, as Phoebe and our entire complete family can attest, it is absolutely essential to ask. Chapter 4. How can I help? Luckily for all of us, many people are interested in helping others. Some devote their careers and lives to it. Not everyone is so inclined, of course, and most people are self-interested, at least some of the time. An evolutionary biologist or psychologist might say that we are always self-interested, and that our effort to help others is simply our attempt to feel good about ourselves. Regardless of our motivations, however, a remarkable number of us help out our colleagues, family, friends, and even strangers. Although admirable, there is a risk in helping others, which is related to the possibility that helping can actually be selfish. That risk lies in falling prey to what some call the savior complex. This is just what it sounds like. An attitude or stance toward the world where you believe you are the expert who can swoop in to save others. It is a lopsided approach to helping, in which the helper believes she has all the answers, knows just what to do, and that the person or group in need has been waiting for a savior to come along. While this is a genuine problem, we should not let the real pitfalls of the savior complex extinguish one of the most humane instincts there is, the instinct to lend a hand. The trick is to help others without believing yourself to be, or acting like you are, their savior. All of which is to say that how you help matters just as much as that you do help. which is why it is essential to begin by asking, how can I help? If you start with this question, you are asking with humility for direction. You are recognizing that others are experts in their own lives, and you are affording them the opportunity to remain in charge, even if you are providing some help. I recently heard a great story on the moth, which underscored the importance of asking how you can help. The Moth is a radio program and podcast that features true stories told live by people from around the world. The stories are riveting, including a recent one from a woman in her 80s who explained how she valued her independence. She loved the fact that she had always taken care of herself and that she could still do so into her 8th decade. And then she had a stroke. While she was in the hospital, her neighbors in her New York City apartment building made some minor renovations to her apartment to make it easier for her to live there with a walker, which she would need after her stroke. At first, she was taken aback, as she was cordial but not good friends with her neighbors. But their gesture of goodwill inspired her to recognize that some dependence on others could actually enrich her life, especially if she reciprocated. So she hung a sign on her apartment door, welcoming her neighbors to come in for a chat. She then recounted how her neighbors often came by to talk and emphasized with gratitude that when they offered to help, they always asked how they could help. By asking her how they could help, she explained, they were allowing her to retain her independence and dignity. In addition to showing respect, asking how you can help is also, not surprisingly, likely to make your assistance more effective. My wife, Katie, asks this question and pays attention to the answer, as well as anyone I know. I could relay many examples, but I'll share just two. In 1996, Katie and I took a bike trip from Nairobi, Kenya to Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe. The trip, which covered over 1,000 miles, took us 6 weeks to complete. It was a remarkable journey from start to finish. We traveled with a haphazardly organized tour group, and our fellow cyclists were mostly British. One, whom I will call Nelson, was in his 60s, tall, lanky, quite pale, and with a slightly eccentric personality. Nelson looked and behaved like the longtime British librarian that he was. When we reached Victoria Falls, we all took hotel rooms to celebrate the completion of our adventure and made plans to meet for dinner. When we went to pick up Nelson, he came to his hotel door quite incoherent. He was, essentially, babbling. Our group thought that Nelson had celebrated the end of a long journey with too much to drink, so we let him be and went to dinner. All during dinner, though, Katie continued to wonder about Nelson, insisting to me that something didn't seem right. So we went back to his hotel room after dinner, and when he came to the door, Katie asked him, "How can we help you, Nelson? You seem like you're having some trouble." In between calling out random letters and numbers, like he was playing bingo or shelving library books, Nelson regained a moment of clarity and said, "I feel a touch off. My head is throbbing." Katie took him to the local hospital and helped him get in to see a doctor, which was no small feat. It turned out that Nelson had cerebral malaria, which is deadly if not treated. The doctor told Katie, in all seriousness, that she had gotten Nelson there just in time. Nelson was helicoptered to a larger hospital in Harare, where he received the treatment he needed. Had Katie not asked Nelson how we could help, and had she just assumed we already knew his problem, Nelson would likely have died in his hotel room. A slightly less dramatic example comes from a case Katie and her colleagues worked on recently. A special education attorney, Katie works at a clinic at Harvard Law School. With her colleagues and law students, she represents poor children who are eligible for special education but are not receiving the services to which they are entitled under state and federal law. Too often in these situations, school officials, doctors, or attorneys will tell the kids and their families what they need. Katie and her colleagues make sure to understand what the kids and their families actually want by asking in one way or another, "How can we help?" One of her clients, whom I will call Robert, came to her when he was 18. Robert had not been to school in about 2 years. He had only a fraction of the credits he needed to graduate high school. Yet he was very capable academically, with an IQ in the 90th percentile. Robert struggled with significant and undiagnosed anxiety, which at times overwhelmed his ability to function. When he was younger, he was frequently absent from school and then stopped going altogether when his father was diagnosed with an advanced brain tumor. Because his mother was working full-time, much of the burden of caring for his father fell on Robert. The school officials considered Robert's case as one of willful truancy. They concluded that Robert simply didn't want to attend school anymore. Thinking they were helping him, school officials advised him to drop out and earn his GED. Because Robert could easily pass the test and then attend a community college, this seemed like an obvious solution. But this was not what Robert wanted, which Katie and her colleagues learned by listening to him. Taking the GED would not help him build skills to manage his anxiety. Besides, Robert had loftier aspirations. He wanted to graduate high school with a regular diploma and go on to a 4-year college. He understood that this would be a challenge, given that he would be much older than his classmates. But he was determined. Katie and her colleagues took the case. Working with Robert, they ultimately convinced the relevant school officials that Robert's absence from school stemmed from an anxiety disorder that needed to be addressed. Robert ended up attending a small public high school for students with emotional disabilities, earned straight A's his first year there, and is on his way to graduating. All because Katie and her colleagues asked, "How can we help?" and then listened to and respected Robert's answer. While Katie instinctively knows to ask this question, I had to be taught its importance. I learned my lesson from a client I will call Patrick, a Cameroonian journalist. I was practicing law in Newark, New Jersey, at a law firm with the memorable but unfortunate name of Crummy Deldeo. This firm sponsored a public interest fellowship and allowed the fellows, of which I was one, to work solely on pro bono cases. It was a great job because it meant I could work on whatever cases interested me the most. Patrick's case intrigued me. Patrick was seeking political asylum. While broadcasting on a state-owned television station about election results in Cameroon, Patrick made the brave and dangerous decision to report, live from the field, on rampant election fraud committed by the government. By the time he got back to his office, police were waiting for him. They took Patrick to prison and, for months, brutally tortured him. On several occasions, they came close to killing him. His mother eventually bribed a prison guard who released Patrick in the middle of the night under the cover of darkness. Patrick then began an odyssey across several continents that ended with his entering the United States under a false passport. When a customs official questioned Patrick about his passport, he admitted it was fake. Though he tried to explain he was seeking asylum, Patrick was arrested and sent to a detention center in Newark, which housed unauthorized immigrants caught at the U.S. border. A human rights group identified Patrick's case and sent it my way. I knew that to satisfy the legal standard for obtaining asylum, the applicant needed to show he had a credible fear of persecution. I set out to get the facts from Patrick that would allow me to make his case. This took a fairly long time, and the asylum process itself moved at a glacial pace. As the process continued to drag on, Patrick grew increasingly despondent. I thought we were making progress, albeit slowly, but Patrick saw endless day after endless day pass by. During one interview, when Patrick offered very brief answers to my questions, I stopped and said that he seemed depressed. And I finally asked him if there was something I could do to help. He said, "I really need to get out of this place. It's killing me to have come all this way only to be in prison again." I knew that being detained was not his first choice and was not anyone's first choice, but I thought it would be a small price to pay if he received asylum. But Patrick's statement jolted me. I started researching more about the asylum process and learned that those awaiting an asylum hearing could be released to a family willing to take them in. Katie and I could not host him because we lived with our newborn son in a tiny apartment, which literally couldn't fit another body. But a generous colleague and her family volunteered to host Patrick, so I temporarily put aside Patrick's asylum case and worked to get him released. Within a couple of weeks, Patrick's petition for release was granted, and he went to live with his host family. He stayed with them for several months while we continued to prepare for his hearing, which I finally came to realize should be Patrick's chance, not mine, to tell his story. So with the expert assistance of a colleague, we worked to help Patrick tell his story. Patrick ultimately received asylum, and he went on to find a good job in New Jersey and create a new life. A few years later, Patrick asked me to serve as a best man at his wedding. The memory of his wedding still brings tears to my eyes. When I later asked him why he wanted me to be his best man, he said, "Because you were my first friend here. You listened to me." Asking how you can help is also an effective way of nudging others to identify, express, and confront their own problems. This is sometimes understandably hard to do, as Atul Gawande describes movingly in Being Mortal, in which he recounts the difficult choices advanced cancer patients must make about their own care. Because facing your own mortality is indescribably difficult, and because doctors naturally want to save patients, it is hard for doctors and patients to have candid discussions about the end of life. But as Gawande points out, cancer patients and their families most need someone to help guide them with candor and compassion. It occurred to me when reading this book that if doctors asked the patients how they could help, before simply pointing out all the various interventions they could perform, they would in a way force the question, which only the patient can answer, "What do you want to do? How do you want to spend what may be your last months of life? How do you want to make that decision? What information would be useful, for example, and who else would you like to include in the conversation?" Asking how you can help is equally effective in less dire circumstances, though for similar reasons. If you ask others how you can help, you are inviting them to take some ownership of their own problems. For this reason, it is a useful question to ask friends, family, and colleagues. It is a particularly useful question, I have found, to ask kids and young adults. In between college and law school, I spent a winter working at a children's ski school in Colorado. I had no training as an instructor, so I spent most of the winter as an inside aide, moving outside to be an instructor for beginning skiers only when most of the other instructors had left for the season. While working with the inside staff, I made lunches, helped kids get on and off their gear, wiped noses, found mittens, and tried to soothe frayed nerves of parents and kids alike. I also made a lot of hot chocolate. The kids were quite young, and some were overwhelmed by it all, just as my own kids were years later when I tried to teach them how to ski. At the ski school, we tried to help as much as we could, which often meant that we made suggestion after suggestion about what the kids could and should do to get comfortable. Most of the time these suggestions worked, but sometimes it just made the kids more agitated. It was as if the obvious futility of our suggestions just confirmed for them how hopeless their situations were. I remember one particularly obstinate 7-year-old boy who refused to go out after lunch for his afternoon ski lesson. I made suggestion after suggestion. Tighten your boots. Pull on your mittens. Wear your goggles. Put on your scarf. With each suggestion, he became more disagreeable until, completely exasperated, I finally asked, "Okay, this isn't working. So maybe you can tell me how I can help you." To my surprise, that question made him pause. He looked around, and then he very quietly said, "I'm still hungry." I made him another PB&J sandwich and sat with him while he ate. He was definitely hungry, but I also think he needed a mental health break. I didn't anticipate it at the time, but by asking him to tell me what he needed, I shifted the burden to him to identify and begin to address what exactly was bothering him. I have found this question very effective as a parent and when working with struggling or unhappy students. As parents and teachers, You try to help solve problems, both big and small. Very often, you think you know what the solution is, so you offer your idea or a whole slew of ideas. Yet sometimes offering solutions simply fuels the anxiety or stubbornness that your kids or students are feeling, just as